shortly from one of my closest friends, lost her father. So I'm going to stop by and show my respect to them. And then I'm going to leave there and hit the road with Aaron Ammons for Clerk. We're canvassing today with people who are volunteering just from everywhere. We're all about, we're in Rantoul today. We're in Champaign-Urbana. We did Muhammad last week. The response has been tremendous. We are looking forward to going into the fall with this, and it'll be a non-traditional campaign.
I'm so
I should
happy
say that.
Even trying to take you out because you don't have any contestation, which means that you can stay doing the radio show.
Yeah, that's correct. That's right, because we'll be in trouble if both of us was, and don't give them no hints, right? So we're going to keep trying to do the best we can with our representation as a state rep. We welcome anybody's question, comments, or anything that they want to say to us. We welcome them. You can always hit me up on Facebook or Twitter or any other medium that you know we're on. And join us. So we appreciate you, Paul. I'm going to let you have it because my time is up, man.
You've got a great day to get out there and walking around the town.
I appreciate the sun and the shine. Mm-hmm. So we're going to turn you over to Paul Muth.
This is what we're going to do for the GEO today. Let's see if I hit the right button here. This was recorded last night at the IMC, one of Carol's old haunting grounds.
Yes, sir.
Last one for this fantastic evening. Thanks again to the IMC, to CLACS, to the Centre for World Music, to ISAMS, to First Fridays. Thank you to Brian and Jason for being fantastic on the organisation front. Anyone else I've missed out? GEO! Singing, I believe that we will win. Singing, I believe that we will win.
I do believe that we will win.
Do you believe that we will win? Thank you very much, guys. Okay, last one tonight. There we go. When I say we, I mean the whole university, this community, because we need graduate students to be in decent conditions for this whole place to work. The university and this town works in part because we do. Okay. How did you win? Come in, clap.
This is Ian
Okay, I'm already 5 minutes into the show. I've got much more than I can. The text cast I'll excerpt, but I'll tell you where you can get a hold of it. I've got a long interview with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz with Jeremy Scahill from the latest Intercepted podcast, and I recommend that to your attention. He was not profane in the first 40 minutes of the show, which is kind of a record for him, but even the commentary. We're going to hear now from Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier. I think I might forego the excellent piece by Mumia Abu-Jamal that you usually feature in here, just for a bright shining hell. I recommend Prison Radio. Listen to Mumia. You have links there to what I think is the case to make for his needing a retrial. I think he should be exonerated, but anyway. Okay, here's Amy Goodman Breaking the Sound Barrier. And it's about the students.
Student massacre survivors teach the country a lesson. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The National Rifle Association didn't see it coming. It could have predicted yet another school shooting, like so many that have happened before in the United States. But what the NRA couldn't predict was the immediate and unrelenting response of the student survivors. They channeled their rage and sorrow over the killing of 17 of their classmates and teachers against the gun lobby and the politicians in their pocket. Pushed by this new momentum for change, President Donald Trump held a bipartisan meeting of congressional lawmakers Wednesday afternoon. The senators and representatives took turns laying out their policy prescriptions while heaping praise on Trump, who took credit in advance for what he said would be a beautiful bill that would pass the Senate with so many votes over the required 60 that it would be unbelievable. Whether any of the proposed policies make it into a comprehensive gun control bill remains to be seen. There are plenty of reasons to be skeptical, including the $54 million the NRA spent on presidential and congressional races during the 2016 election cycle. Democratic Congressmember Elizabeth Esty of Connecticut, who took office just after the Sandy Hook massacre, offered one undeniable truth at the bipartisan meeting, saying,
"We're at a tipping point. We're at a tipping point, and why we are, I don't know, but I think it's the students." You know,
the student survivors of the Valentine's Day massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School are the heart of the movement for gun control. They're embracing one of the strongest currents in United States history, the tradition of youth activism. By now, many of the Parkland, Florida survivors are nationally recognized, like Emma Gonzalez, whose fiery speech days after the shooting ignited the movement, or David Hogg, director of the school's student-run TV station, whose impactful media appearances contributed to a disgraceful right-wing conspiracy theory that he and others were actually trained crisis actors, and Sam Zeef, who at the White House listening session told the president,
"These are not weapons of defense. These are weapons of war. I still can't fathom that I'm myself am able to purchase one."
Others helped organize a trip of over 100 survivors from Parkland to Tallahassee, Florida, to push the state legislature for an assault weapons ban. While the effort failed, the students emerged more determined than ever. Youth activism goes back a long way in the United States. In 1903, Mary Harris Jones, the legendary Irish labor organizer known popularly as Mother Jones, led a march of hundreds of striking child laborers and their parents from Philadelphia to New York City. They were fighting against the scourge of child labor. The civil rights movement was propelled by youth activists. Claudette Colvin was just 15 when she refused to give up her seat for a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama, 9 months before Rosa Parks did the same thing. Colvin told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"I could not move because history had me glued to the seat." And they say, "How is that?" I say, "Because it felt like soldier on the truth. Hands were pushing me down on one shoulder, and Harriet Tubman hands were pushing me down on another shoulder, and I could not move. And I yell out, 'It's my constitutional rights.'"
One of the principal architects of the nonviolent strategy used by Martin Luther King Jr. was James Lawson, who received his ministry license in high school in 1947. He, in turn, trained countless activists, including John Lewis, who was a leader of the Nashville movement to desegregate lunch counters in the South and was one of the original freedom riders who braved beatings, arrests, angry mobs, and death threats as they rode buses to force the desegregation of the interstate bus system. John Lewis was just 23 when he addressed the 1963 March on Washington, where King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. In deference to suggestions made by his elders, made by King and fellow march organizer A. Philip Randolph, Lewis edited his speech.
I was asked to change the speech. Some people thought the speech was too radical, too militant. I thought it was a speech for the occasion. It represented the people that we were working with.
I'd like to play Danny Glover reading the excerpts of the speech that you didn't give.
To those who have said, be patient and wait, we must say that patience is a dirty and nasty word. Mm-hmm. We cannot be patient. We do not want to be free gradually. We want our freedom and we want it now.
The Parkland students have called for a national march for our lives on March 24th in Washington, D.C., with sister marches around the country. They've raised over $3 million to support the organizing effort. Emma Gonzalez wrote in Harper's Bazaar, march with us on March 24th. Register to vote. Actually show up to the polls because we need to relieve the NRA of its talking points once and for all, she wrote. There are concurrent calls for nationwide high school student walkouts to demand gun control on March 14th, as well as April 20th, the 19th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, speaking of nonviolent direct action, I see that there's a day-long workshop. I guess probably you go in and get oriented. It's taking place next weekend, this, starting at 8:30 at the UU's on Green Street in Urbana. It says, join the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. You can search around for details on that. Nonviolent Direct Action Training is the title on Facebook. Okay, let's get to a couple of cultural things. Well, I should give a shout out to Mitch Altman. He's a maker hero over at Allen Hall. Everyone's welcome in the community. You might remember him from some years ago if you've been around a while. Allen Hall on campus, but it's on the east end. You can park in the neighborhood and walk over pretty easily. Let's see. I mentioned the large ensemble Timbaloo that did the show last night. There's an art show next weekend at the IMC with a large ensemble called Knights of Cabiria. They're kicking it off around noon, but you can find information for that in the week hence. Resist 2.0 is the name of the art fair, and it's a follow-on to last year's very successful event. Also playing on that stage there at the IMC, Almost A, Quintet Fraction. It's actually Doro Maturana on violin, and that'll be with someone who's not in the Ms. M and the Jokers group typically, but Kirsten Johns will be playing cello, so that'll also be on the musical offerings. Almost Day, I mentioned, because they're playing their pretty regular first Saturday of the month show at the Iron Post tonight between 6 and 8. Okay, I ate up some more time here. Let's get right to it. I was thinking about cutting out this humorous piece. At least I find it pretty blackly humorous. If you can name other people in this panoply of speakers from CPAC other than Sebastian Gorka, you can call them in and I'll have time to mention who those people were. But anyway.
Dismal swamp, hidden beneath its murky waters, lies the headquarters of the most sinister villains of all time. The Legion of Doom.
The annual Conservative Political Action Conference is taking place this week in Maryland. Next, Vice President Mike Pence speaks to attendees on topics including a wall on the southern border, North Korea, and the 2018 midterm elections.
The meeting will come to order. The Legion of Doom is now in session. We have gathered together the 13 most ruthless villains on Earth. The sinister mind of Sinestro.
Push back on the fake news. They're liars.
The awesome Bizarro.
Crying white mothers are ratings gold.
And the super intelligent computer android Brainiac.
Political correctness is dying a slow, painful, bloody, agonizing death, and all I can say is hell yeah.
The feminine yet ferocious giganta.
The trashing of our Judeo-Christian ethics and an America overrun by people who actually hate our guts.
And the humorous but sinister Riddler.
I call young people Generation Freedom. The internet should be free.
Not to mention the evil genius and brilliant leader.
I'm thrilled to be back at CPAC.
So what are we doing? What are we doing? This is called the snake. And think of it in terms of immigration. Immigration.
You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Nothing will stop us now. With our combined powers of evil, we must pledge to wipe out the Super Friends. One for all, and all for doom.
I just have to cut in and imagine what Oscar Brown would be saying if he knew that Trump would be using his song to that effect. This, I can't say it off the air, so I'm turning off the mic.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 46 of Intercepted.
The band of Blackbirds, which swaggered into the state's capital yesterday carrying rifles and pistols, today was herded into Sacramento Municipal Court to face criminal charges of conspiracy.
On May 2nd, 1967, two dozen men and six women marched into the California State Capitol building in Sacramento. They were carrying pistols, shotguns, and rifles. But this was not a SWAT team or a security force, at least not a government one. In fact, this heavily armed group was more of a, well, well-organized militia. And they'd come to the Capitol that day to try to stop the legislature and the state's governor from passing a law that would strip them of their ability to openly carry their weapons as they patrolled the streets of their neighborhoods and communities in an effort to keep people safe.
The California Penal Code section 12020 through 12027 and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property. And the legislature, I talked to Morford last night and he said the legislature has made certain rules that are superior to the United States Constitution and also superior to the statutory law of California, and that is that they made a rule that no one could walk on their property with a weapon. I'm saying this is a bold contradiction, and also Morford is a liar.
Now, it may come as a surprise to some of you, given today's discourse on guns, to discover that the National Rifle Association and the Republican governor of California at the time, Ronald Reagan, came out passionately in an effort to strip this militia's right to carry arms.
But I would think that some of the bills that have been suggested, such as not carrying a loaded weapon on a city street or in town, this might certainly be a good one. There is absolutely no reason why out on the street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon.
Why was Ronald Reagan so up in arms? After all, California was an open carry state. These Americans were exercising their God-given Second Amendment rights. So what was the problem?
Wait a minute. Am I under arrest? Am I under arrest?
Am I under arrest? Go ahead,
brother. Am I under arrest? Take your hands off me if I'm not under arrest.
That militia that marched into the Capitol that day was the Black Panther Party. And the street patrols that they were engaged in were operations to protect their communities from the police. Police that had been targeting, abusing, and killing black people.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take full note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless at the very same time that racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people. At the same time that the American government is waging...
California lawmakers were terrified when the Black Panthers came into the Capitol. Some of them reportedly hid under their desks. The entire establishment, including the gun lobby, denounced the armed black people. And the bill, which became known as the Panther Bill, was aimed at taking away what the NRA and the Republicans portrayed as their sacred rights as Americans. In fact, the Panthers in the Capitol that day were charged with felonies.
FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover today asserted that the Black Panthers represent the greatest internal threat to the nation. Hoover said the Panthers have perpetrated numerous assaults on police and have engaged in violent confrontations throughout the country.
This so-called Panther Bill made one thing clear. Having armed Black revolutionaries patrolling their own neighborhoods with weapons was seen as a greater threat than all Californians losing the right to openly carry weapons. In fact, this bill resulted in some of the strictest gun control laws anywhere in the United States at the time, all because some Black Americans exercised their right to carry loaded weapons. And around that same time, major media outlets across the United States were aghast as Malcolm X called on Black people to arm themselves and to defend themselves against racist violence. Malcolm X regularly cited the Second Amendment in asserting the rights of Black people to bear arms for self-defense. Listen to how Malcolm X was questioned about this.
You have called for self-defense units, rifle clubs, ready to execute on the spot those who threaten Negroes.
I don't think that I said that.
Yes, you did.
No, I don't think I said that.
All right.
I have called for rifle clubs that I think Negroes should, in areas where the police, whether it be federal, state, or city, have proven their inability or their unwillingness to defend Negroes, the lives and the property of Negroes, then it's only intelligent and it's only right that Negroes protect themselves. And I have encouraged them to buy a rifle and a shotgun, which according to the Constitution is legal.
For what purpose?
So that at any time anyone makes any effort whatsoever to brutalize them or attack them or endanger them, they should have something to defend themselves.
This history of the reaction of white communities, the white media, to Black gun ownership is a very telling one, because it reveals that the sanctity of the Second Amendment for all Americans is a myth. It's a myth today, and it's been a myth from the beginning. The real history of gun laws in the U.S. is not about hunting, and it's not about fighting tyranny. For the most part, if we're really being honest, it's been about white people having the right to bear arms and to use them against Black people, indigenous people, and other not real Americans. Just to put this in perspective, more than 80% of gun owners in the United States are white, and the majority of those are men. And it's no coincidence that gun sales skyrocketed during the administration of the first Black president of the United States.
You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends. But you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland, where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what
you
it takes.
You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men.
No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
The NRA even ran ads talking about Obama's daughters and the protection that they received while their father was president.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security. Protection for their kids and gun-free zones for ours.
Here's the thing. The Second Amendment is not in danger at all, and it wasn't during Obama's time in office. In the so-called debate around guns in the United States, the Second Amendment is treated as sacrosanct by both Democrats and Republicans alike. Yes, there are wide differences in opinion. Some Democrats want all assault weapons banned. Others say that the Second Amendment is really about hunting or sport. But almost all major party politicians support keeping the Second Amendment on the books.
Well, first of all, I support the Second Amendment. I lived in Arkansas for 18 wonderful years. I represented upstate New York. I understand and respect the tradition of gun ownership. It goes back to the founding of our country.
The Washington consensus is that the Second Amendment is set in stone, and we just need to tweak various laws and regulations to make sure that the bad guys don't get the guns, or that certain guns should not be gettable. But that's really about it. That's all that's being debated. Here's what Barack Obama, after being confronted by a gun enthusiast at a town hall, had to say about his position on guns.
First of all, the notion that I
or Hillary or Democrats or whoever you want to choose, are hell-bent on taking away folks' guns is just not true. And I don't care how many times the NRA says it. I'm about to leave office. There have been more guns sold since I've been president than just about any time in U.S. history. There are enough guns for every man, woman, and child in this country. And at no point have I ever proposed confiscating guns from responsible gun owners. So it's just not true.
Back in the early 1990s, the conservative Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger broke with orthodoxy on this issue, and he said that modern interpretation of the Second Amendment was a dangerous joke. Here's Berger on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour in 1991.
If I were writing the Bill of Rights now, there wouldn't be any such thing as the Second Amendment.
Which says?
That a well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of the state, the people's rights to bear arms. This has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime. Now just look at those words. There are only three lines to that amendment. A well-regulated militia. If the militia, which was going to be the state army, was going to be well-regulated, why shouldn't 16 and 17 and 18 or any other age persons be regulated in the use of arms the way an automobile is regulated?
Justice Berger's straight talk was certainly out of the norms of Washington debate. He'd probably be crucified today for saying some of the things he said. The NRA is basically one massive dog whistle about white people protecting themselves from dangerous non-white people. And more recently from Antifa and protesters and opponents of Donald Trump. And well, let's just let Dana Loesch rant in this NRA ad.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
There's a new book that just came out that lays out a provocative argument for getting rid of the Second Amendment in its entirety. And the book asserts that the NRA has become a white nationalist organization. That book is titled Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. And it was written by the radical historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Her book tells a very different tale about the so-called gun culture in the United States and about how the Second Amendment was, at its core, a solidifying of the rights of white people to bear arms, to steal native land by force, to capture so-called runaway slaves, and to prevent rebellions from oppressed people. It wasn't about hunting. It wasn't about protecting against the tyranny of government. It wasn't about simply protecting your property from criminals and thieves. Sure, those arguments are made by Second Amendment enthusiasts, and they're certainly representative of a lot of people's motives for possessing guns.
Hi, I'm Chuck Norris, a black belt patriot. If some thug breaks into my home, I could use my roundhouse kick, but I'd prefer he look down the barrel of my gun. And millions of other laws.
It's all well and good to find white action heroes to extol the virtues of gun ownership and how American-y it is to own those guns. But what's the actual history behind the Second Amendment? It's a question we rarely hear discussed in our society, but it is our focus right now. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is the author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, and Blood on the Border, A Memoir of the Contra War. Her latest book, again, is called Loaded. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz joins me now. Welcome to Intercepted.
Thank you, Jeremy.
If the United States has a gun culture, what is that gun culture?
It's a weapon of settler colonialism all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Argentina, where settler colonialism was used. But in the United States, by putting it in the Constitution as that sacred document, as an individual right, it veered considerably from those other settler colonies. From the very beginning, guns and ammunition were required in the colonies in Virginia and then in Massachusetts Bay Colony and then Virginia first, that every man, every household had to have a firearm and a certain amount of gunpowder and bullets. And if they couldn't afford that, the colonial government would subsidize it. So what were they so afraid of that they had to have all these guns? Because they were on land that they had stolen by burning people's villages down, by killing, raping, maiming, and driving Native people into the periphery where they fought back and tried to regain their land and also keep them from taking more. So U.S. settler colonialism was really required, the whole buildup of the United States, a white nationalist democracy. Every man a king with land, and of course then institutionalized slavery took hold by the 1670s. Out of these militias, they carved slave patrols as well. So that dual usage, you know, the right to own human bodies and land and to steal them, kidnap people and kill people, really genocide, is just written into the very cellular structure of the United States, the Constitution, every institution. And that plus the militarism that lasted from before, during, and after independence and continued until 1890, more than 100 years of daily, moment-by-moment warfare against Native people, at the same time invading other countries, the Barbary Wars in 1806 and 1809, and then Mexico, 1846 to 48. That just continued and continued and then jumped over the Pacific and into the Caribbean and then to the whole world. So the militarism is the key component of it. And only a third of the population even own a gun. And there's a good portion of those who are combat vets.
The exact text, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, I'm not asking you about more recent interpretations by various courts, but at that time, in 1789, when they were referring to a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, what was the historical context and what did they refer to when they were talking about well-regulated militia?
Well, they certainly weren't talking about state militias because those were provided for in the Constitution itself. That's the genealogy of the National Guard. But the Bill of Rights, which was came later, the amendments, these were individual rights, very specifically individual rights. So they could only have referred to the existing citizens' militias. But they came to be self-organized. They were very well organized for selfish interests, for their own purpose. The state, the government had no authority over them whatsoever. And this was how the whole continent was taken, was these settlers themselves organized. Every settler, a soldier, they're all armed, they say, out in their fields and everything, and they're all well organized. So they could, in minutes, you know, call up a militia. And they knew what to do, you know, it was in their self-interest. So,
well, what were these militia doing?
Killing Indians, taking their land. That's what they were doing. And then the land was theirs. And the slave patrols were also self-organized. It was really every white man had an obligation to keep an eye out, even if they didn't own slaves, to keep an eye out and turn in any stray black person that didn't have a permit on him, that he's doing some errand for the owner. And if he didn't have that, then he was considered a renegade, you know, and had to be captured and returned to the owner.
Right. You write in the book, and this is a quote, "The astronomical number of firearms owned by U.S. civilians with the Second Amendment considered a sacred mandate is also intricately related to militaristic culture and white nationalism. The militias referred to in the Second Amendment were intended as a means for white people to eliminate indigenous communities in order to take their land and for slave patrols to control black people."
Slave patrols, several scholars have traced the genealogy of slave patrols into modern police forces. So we still see the controlling of especially young black men by police forces. It's not just history. It has led up to the exact kind of situation, both militaristic and institutionally violent society that we have now.
When you listen and watch the current debate about guns in this country, what is your critique of the way that the Second Amendment is discussed by opponents of guns? Can you lay out your perspective on that?
You know, their arguments are you don't need an automatic weapon, you don't need an assault rifle to kill a deer. It is so stupid. It was never, ever, ever about hunting. It's never had anything to do with that. And of course, for these gun nuts, you know, they think that is hilarious because they know what guns are for. Guns are to kill people. The other argument that liberals make is they create a bogeyman. It's all about money. And it's advertising and sales. And, you know, you could say it's capitalism. Well, of course, everything is related to the evils of capitalism, but it's not all about money. There is a populist base. It's very large and it's much larger. I consider the NRA the largest and most powerful hardcore white nationalist organization, maybe in the world right now, except maybe for the US government at this point. But they argue that either the gun industry or the NRA are both together in cahoots are the problem. It's because they have so much money and they bribe congressmen. What they do is get these people unelected or elected or out of office through their base. They are a mass-based organization with chapters everywhere in the United States. And they're activists. That is what they live for. They are gun nuts, gun fetishes, and they're one-third of the population. 80% of those are white, but 61% are white males. That is the constituency. It's like liberals and even a lot of leftists do not want to face the fact that there's this much power. There's been very little legislation ever because as long as it was a nice, secure white republic up to World War II, with Jim Crow fully in charge, legal segregation, redlining and everything throughout the North, it was secure. And then the civil rights movement, which of course had always gone on, black resistance, native resistance, but it had a great success right after World War II, and that was the desegregation decision of the Supreme Court. That was the trigger. That was the earthquake, the tsunami that set off the new wave of white supremacy. It wasn't really even needed. It always was there, but it wasn't really needed in an organized way as long as they controlled everything. I mean, they ran the whole government. Southern senators ran the Senate. They had nothing to worry about. So you see this tighten up with the founding of the LAPD, the new LAPD. It was an all-white paramilitary, white nationalist police force. It's never really lost that veneer or structure. It still has problems. You know, this is a rebellion. This is a counter-revolution that started, really at the time of the first victory and built up and built up until it was taken over. The NRA was taken over by a gun nuttery group founded 2 years earlier, Harlan Carter, a former vicious Border Patrol agent.
Thanks to you, the members and supporters of NRA, no national gun law has passed this year. We will stand together, strong, dedicated, shoulder to shoulder for what is right.
And they infiltrated and got the vote and took over the NRA. That's when it became a completely white supremacist organization and started emphasizing the Second Amendment.
Any national gun law, no matter how innocent in appearance, presupposes a still further growth in a centralized, computerized gun control bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., a monstrous invasion of the rights to privacy of you law-abiding and decent people who have never committed a crime and concerning whom there's no evidence you ever will.
You write, by the time of its 1977 convention, the Second Amendment Foundation and its lobbying arm, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, which was founded in Washington State in 1974, seized leadership of the NRA. And you state the Constitution is the sacred text of the civic religion that is U.S. nationalism. And that nationalism is inexorably tied to white supremacy.
Yes, we are weird in the world in the United States with this sanctification of a constitution. They built into the constitution almost an inability to change it. But again, the originalism arose with this counter-revolution against black freedom. But it really is an individual right. It was meant to be an individual right from the very beginning. So, you know, it really needs to be abolished. That's what needs to be. But it's not the vehicle that produces the violence. It's the violence that leans on this phony sacred object, the Second Amendment, to the point that even all these liberal Congress people, you hear them over and over preceding their efforts for gun control by, well, I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment, but...
But we have millions of people who are gun owners in this country. 99.9% of those people obey the law. I want to see real serious debate and action on guns. But it is not going to take place if we simply have extreme positions on both sides.
But that's ridiculous, you know? What are they supporting? You know, do they know what they're supporting? And then other liberals like Nancy Pelosi, they argue that it's out of date. And if they think through what that means, it means, well, we don't have to kill Indians anymore, you know?
We all support the right of the Second Amendment right to bear arms.
She forgets we still have to kill black people, though, apparently, and Muslims and Mexicans. So it's really an ineffective argument because they just go round and round. Well, if you really believe in the Second Amendment, but I've heard it before. They say, oh, these old guns back then, you know, if we had individual right to a musket and plenty of gunpowder, then that would be fine. Oh, but, you know, they killed a hell of a lot of Indians with those muskets. They were good with those things. You know, they had whole wars. People were killed in Europe with muskets. It's not nothing.
Well, and you also write quite bluntly, white nationalists are the irregular forces, the volunteer militias of the actually existing political economic order. They are provided for in the Second Amendment.
Yeah, they are. If people want that, then they should continue supporting the Second Amendment. But if they want to find out what the Second Amendment is really about, and that takes a historical contextualization because it wasn't even debated at the time. It was already in the colonists. When they broke away with the Declaration of Independence, they each formed sovereign states. And of course, the Constitution, 7-8 years later, was to bring them together in a federation. But in their constitutions, they had already put in the mandate for the continuation of these citizens' militias and the right of carrying arms. And Thomas Jefferson wrote the one in the Virginia Constitution and imported it, you know, to the Bill of Rights. So there was no discussion. There was no argument. No one said, oh, should we do this? Is it an individual right? There was no argument. Everyone knew what it was about. What else could it have been for since they had actual state militias and the army and the navy in the Constitution?
You mentioned earlier, you were giving some of the statistics, 74% of gun owners in the United States are male, 82% of gun owners are white, meaning 61% of all adults who own guns are white men, and that group is around 30% of the total U.S. population. And then I'm quoting here, the top reason U.S. Americans give for owning a gun is for protection. What are the majority of white men so afraid of? Does anyone believe that centuries of racial and economic domination of the United States by white men have left no traces in our culture, views, or institutions? What are you saying there?
White men have a problem. We have a problem with white men. It's not the people I come from, the tenant farmers, the sharecroppers, the poor people. They have their own gun problems. And it really is the powerful defense industry, the powerful agribusiness industry, more and more the tech industry. That, I think, is we have to bring class into the... I tell you, most of the poor white men in this country can't afford those. Weapons are very expensive. I mean, the really nice ones are very expensive. The average gun owner owns 8. And that means some people, like the Las Vegas shooter, he owned something like 45 high-powered weapons, all bought legally. And he was a very wealthy man, you know. So, and then we get into ROTC, junior ROTC, in all the schools teaching little kids to shoot lethal weapons. Many of them, of course, go into the actual army. But this kid in Florida was from age 11 in junior ROTC, and he was a fanatic. Everyone interviewed said all he would ever talk about was guns, 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 and ROTC. And yet in these funerals, you know, and all, they're honoring these JROTC kids who were killed and not at all putting any focus on these defense industry-funded programs in all of our public schools and even middle schools.
And in the book, you make that connection. You're talking about the way that we discuss so-called mass shootings in our society. And you write, just why these events, horrific as they are and tragic for the families and communities traumatized by senseless violence and loss, loom so large in the public mind is a mystery, when during the entire period since the 1966 Whitman massacre, the United States has perpetrated massive amounts of violence around the world, responsible for killing millions of people and families. What you're talking about there is something that you, I don't know if we've ever heard that kind of connection being made from politicians on Capitol Hill. The idea that all of these wars that the United States is engaged in around the world to this moment, and all of that history of slaughtering indigenous people, the slave patrols, the lynchings, etc., that they are also connected to the violence that we see happening in our movie theaters, our churches, and our schools.
Well, I'm going to let you look for the answer at The Intercepted. That's Rose Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. The book before this was The Indigenous People's History of the United States. And now this book they're talking about here is called Loading, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Very timely. I see she, from her Twitter feed, she has an essay out called The Soul-Crushing Legacy of Billy Graham. So she has a wide-ranging view of things. I forget where she's ensconced in academia. Graduated from San Francisco State. Born in San Antonio. Okay, I wanted to get on some of the Tax Justice Network's monthly tax cast. They turn their eye on the U.S. and the tax reform, deform. I think it's an important issue. It doesn't get enough scrutiny, in my opinion. So some of it's pretty basic. Some of it's insightful, I think. But I think it's probably quite important for people to have these talking points. So I did have some announcements from the WEFT calendar lined up here. YMCA is having their next Sunday, the 35th Annual International Dinner and Performance Night. I haven't been in a while. Might be time to go. I've just been contacted by Jason at UPTV, the audio from the camcorder at Jason Spatterson, very important talks, part of the series at the Friday Forum on America's compounding moral debt, is not available. They do have another alternate recording. I usually go in and record it alternately, but I didn't this time because I'm a little cumbered with my arm in a sling and all. But looking to see if I can get that audio, and I've just sent a message to Jason Patterson about maybe he can just come in on Wednesdays and we'll chat a little bit about his artwork, exposing and illustrating what he calls the compounding moral debt of the U.S. I had a couple of others, but college and prison program mural, it's an ongoing thing also in Urbana in the near the Common Ground Food Cup. I guess I would put it in the Lincoln Square Mall. It's a project of Education Justice Project. They have some students who are incarcerated do some pieces, and I guess they're up on the walls in there. I haven't noticed. But that's an ongoing thing till the 16th. But without further ado, how much time do we have? That's the wrong thing to click. TaxCast. About 11 minutes of it. You can find this, just look for taxjustice.net.uk or just search for Tax Justice. I like the way she starts out. I was thinking about editing out the beginning of this, but well, it's nice to hear the Mrs. Porter's son's tune here as well.
Cast special feature. Last month's new Financial Secrecy Index results put the United States in second place on our Tax Justice Network roll of dishonour. And that's not only bad news for citizens in other countries because the United States is eroding their tax base and facilitating criminality, it's hurting US citizens too. Because a political leadership that's okay with money laundering and tax cheating comes from the same mentality that's killing the American dream and turning it into the American nightmare. This month, the TaxCast looks at President Trump's tax reforms and human rights in the country.
Hasn't been done in 34 years, but actually really hasn't been done because we broke every record. It's the largest, I always say the most massive, but it's the largest tax cut in the history of our country and reform, but tax cut. Really something special.
At the end of 2017, President Trump got through his tax reform bill and signed it into law. The bill was rushed through, and you can get a bit of a taste of the frustration about that from an angry Senator Elizabeth Warren here.
So here it is Friday night, and I just want to give you an idea of how the Republican leadership thinks we're supposed to make laws in the United States Senate. They have just released the tax bill. It is about 500 pages, and they want us to vote on this thing in about an hour. An hour. I spent more than an hour making a decision about the refrigerator that we recently bought. But the Republicans think that they can cram through a tax bill that will affect every family in America, that will touch every business in America, and they can do it by just jamming through a bunch of paper and telling everybody to go vote on it.
As others have said, this is not a tax reform, it's a tax deform.
Nicholas Luciani at the Center for Economic and Social Rights.
The U.S. can only be called a laughingstock amongst democracies after this tax bill process. It was rushed through in the middle of the night. There were no real hearings or public debate. It was thoroughly undemocratic. And the results have been really terrible. I'm sure in the coming years there will be a reckoning.
I'm sure there will, because just as the gaps between rich and poor on every measure are going through the roof, the Trump administration's tax reforms look set to make a bad situation even worse. They've dropped the official corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, an amount few, if any, multinationals are actually paying anyway. We know that US companies already pay an average of 14%, and of course the really, really big ones pay much less than that, and some pay no federal income tax at all. So you get this bizarre result where low-income workers are paying proportionately more in tax than these huge multinational corporations. Trump's provided various tax cuts for high earners, some small cuts for middle earners that disappear in stages over time. Companies like Apple got what multinationals have been lobbying for years, to repatriate profits they've been hoarding offshore at a massively reduced rate. Something's got to give. Someone's got to pay for these cuts, right, Nicholas?
Absolutely. There are more than 45 million people living in the U.S. in poverty. That's one in seven Americans in a country that's the richest in history. Inequality is growing. Intergenerational mobility is growing. We have very wide racial disparities in everything from education to healthcare to housing to wages, and in wealth inequalities between racial groups are huge and growing. There are acute gender disparities in all of these areas as well. And the so-called recovery since the recession has been the most lopsided in U.S. history, with something like 95% of the gains going to the top 1%. The Trump tax bill is deepening these. As we know, it's giving 80% of the tax benefits to the richest 1%. So extraordinary shift of income and wealth from the low and middle income households to the rich. And how will all this be paid for? We know that it's going to create a $1.5 trillion debt over 10 years. This is a perfect kind of textbook pretext for creating backdoor cuts to essential programs to reduce inequality and lift poverty.
Right, and the levels of poverty and deprivation in the United States are so bad, they're now provoking strong criticism. United Nations Rapporteur on Poverty and Human Rights, Professor Philip Alston, has just completed an investigative mission there.
$2 a day
in the rest of the world, which is the accepted international poverty line, or almost, it's actually $1.90 a day, according to the World Bank, that would reasonably be translated to something like $4 a day in the United States. And if one used that as a benchmark, there would be more than 5 million Americans who are living in absolute poverty that would be below international standards. In other words, the sort of standards that we think are highly problematic in developing countries like India or Nepal or wherever. You've got more than 5 million Americans living at that level. So it means that people have virtually no cash to spend. They are dependent on what they can eke out from family and friends, from very inadequate government benefits, which in any event these days give them increasingly little cash. So they rely on food stamps, which they can only use to buy certain types of food and so on. A lot of people who are living at the poverty line can't get government-funded health coverage, health care. I think these people are living an extremely precarious life. If a tooth falls out or a shoe is lost or a child has an accident, there's no money at all to pay for that. And I think that's the sort of existence that probably some 20 million Americans are experiencing.
You talk about the betrayal of the American dream and its replacement with the American illusion. What do you mean by that?
Well, the American dream essentially is built on this notion of a very high degree of mobility within the society, so that people who are born in very poor socioeconomic circumstances can nonetheless rise to the very top of the society. And this was for a very long time, and still is, in fact, in common parlance, the way in which Americans think of their society. The reality, though, is that statistics show that the United States actually has less social mobility than any of the other developed countries. And in fact, increasingly, one can predict based on the zip code where someone is born and lives what their life chances are, meaning that if you're born in a zip code or a suburb which is very poor, you're highly unlikely to change your circumstances significantly. And vice versa, that if you're born in a rich zip code, your chances of making it are very high.
And in terms of making a bad situation even worse, one thing that really stands out as a result of President Trump's tax reforms are that an estimated 13 million people could lose health insurance, and that could result in 10,000 avoidable deaths. Some are hoping it'll all be worth it in the end because of the boost to the economy it's going to bring, the jobs are going to come rolling in, and it's all going to be great. But citizens in Kansas are watching all this in horror.
As an American citizen and as a Kansan, I don't want to see everyone else in the country have to go through what Kansas just did. As a Kansan, that is really what gets under my skin, is that no one seems to have learned the lessons.
This is Rachel Cross, policy analyst at Frontier Group, a think tank research and public policy center. A strikingly similar tax reform was carried out by their governor, Sam Brownback, back in 2012. They're still digging themselves out of it. Even fellow Republicans are repealing it.
Mr. Speaker, the governor of the state of Kansas.
Please admit the Honorable Sam Brownback, governor of the state of Kansas.
Kansans rue the day when Governor Brownback took up the reins in their state. He cut taxes across the board with a 0% income tax rate for some companies. It was supposed to be a shot of adrenaline into the heart of the Kansas economy. It was all going to be great, but his economic revolution just didn't happen. Tax revenues dried up, the state used up all the money in the piggy bank, and then the really serious cuts started. Tell us about that.
So the biggest result of the tax plan was some serious revenue deficiencies, and a lot of really short-term decisions came from our public officials about how to plug these budget holes that were caused by the tax plan. And it really culminated with severe, severe cuts to the public education budget. You know, and in fact, the cuts to that education budget got so bad that the state Supreme Court two times ruled that the underfunding of the public school system was unconstitutional. For instance, my childhood school district cut 3 weeks from the beginning of the school year to save on August air conditioning costs. It breaks my heart, because who's really going to have to pay the consequences of this? It's going to be our children.
How did parents cope with the three extra week